Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
Dan, we got it all going on today.
All of it?
All of it. We got the laundry is going.
Mm-hmm.
I know people love this. I got the door open to the other room. Lauren is in the other room doing a hilarious thing, which is... she's filling in, I think for the United Airlines Frequent Flyer program, she's filling in security questions. And, you know, again, her point is, and she's exactly right, it's a freaking frequent flyer plan. Like, this is not a bank. Why do we need five security questions? And I told her the thing that people do, which is they put in nonsense and just save it in one password as their security questions, because then they're more secure. And she pointed out that in United, you have to pick from a list. All the security questions are like, what month did you meet your spouse? Or what is your favorite breed of dog? And they have a list of approved choices.
So it's such a dumb system.
You can't even freeform it. It's like, why are you doing this? What are you doing?
Yeah, there's a better way. I mean, I don't know. It's one of those things, too. Like, I've been glad to see the expansion of two-factor authentication, but we've now moved to the next stage, which is trying, you know, hopefully eliminating the use of text messages for two-factor authentication, because there are not only security issues with that, but there are also occasional other, like, you, as I, have traveled abroad and switched and swapped SIMs. If you have your text messages set up to go to your phone, you're kind of screwed at that point.
Yeah.
So you can make an end run around that. I've had stuff go to like a Google Voice number and obviously the other solution is to use like an app like the Google Authenticator or Authy or 1Password to do your two-factor codes. And that's kind of where we're moving to, which is good because it's more secure, but... it's also annoying.
Yeah, but, you know, 1Password will... this is the thing that really got me to finally abandon Authy, is that 1Password puts your code on the clipboard when it autofills.
Yeah, somebody told me that, and I thought to myself, I may need to move to
it's
that.
It's pretty great.
But I've been lazy.
1Password is integrated in iOS 12, so you just do that and authenticate. And so literally, I can be on a site and go, you know, boop, enter it in. It just... Face ID pops it in there, puts the thing on the clipboard, paste that in, and I'm good. It's pretty great. But yeah, I agree. I have been in that position where I've had we're going to send you a code, and I'm like, no, I don't have that SIM in right now. I can't do that. But I suppose we'll get there. I did have a moment where I was moving Julian to Jamie's old iPhone 6S. We did the iPhone trickle down, which is very exciting for everybody. And I was trying to figure out I was wiping his old device, and I had one of those moments where it wanted to send me a two-factor thing, and I'm like, I don't know if this Apple ID is logged in anywhere else. Like, can I do this? And that's a little bit nerve-wracking, right? Like, what happens if I have no authenticated devices? It's pretty scary. And I get that's one of the challenges if you're Apple, is like every decision you make that has a point at which if the user fails to do something, it's irrevocably like just gone. That is not great, even though sometimes I think about this a lot now. When I'm confronted with user experience decisions that Apple makes, and I realize that somebody in Apple's security group has gone to great lengths to game this entire process to figure out if they're like the way that they have to do it so that this isn't a security hole. And when I was setting up my new iPhone, that's the moment where I thought about, because they have that great feature where you can transfer your stuff now. You say you have two phones that are near each other, and you say, yes, I want to transfer it to this. And then you take a picture, and then you put in your password for your one phone on your other phone, and then it transfers some stuff. And I thought, that's a really interesting set of steps. And when you think about it, you're like, okay, what they're trying to do is ensure that the phones have proximity, that you know the password of the originating phone and enter it in on the new phone. So you have to have both devices and knowledge of the password. Like, obviously they broke down like exactly how you do this, so you can't use this process to steal
someone's phone.
And, you know, it's fascinating because the push and pull there, if you're an Apple security person, I think it actually would be a fascinating job, because Apple security people, they know that they need to have iPhone security be rock solid, but it's Apple. They also know that they really can't ideally get away with bad user experiences, that the bar is set fairly high on, you know, we don't want this to be crappy. And to be fair to them, in the last 3 years, the iPhone setup experience is so much better than it used to be. They have done a great job on making it better, but that's a hard problem, right? About how do we do this, but also do it securely.
Yeah, I was I've been impressed by it, because I've gone through this process pretty much every year, as you have, and it's gotten progressively smoother over the course of the iPhone's existence. I mean, like other things too. I mean, I'm on the iPhone upgrade program, and that process likewise has become more and more streamlined over the years. They've even in the last year or two, transferring a watch from one phone to another is better than it used to be, because it used to be this complicated process.
It's like,
at what point during this process do I unpair my watch and pair it with my new phone? Right,
because you also want to back up your data and all that. No. Starting this year, when you get a new phone, it actually says, hey, your old phone had a watch attached to it.
Yep.
Do you want me to move that watch to the new place? And then it moves the watch, which that was not possible before. The only way to do it before
seems ridiculous,
was to unpair the watch,
which backs up all the data onto the phone
and wipes the watch.
Yeah.
And then repair it. And it's like so bad. And it's not perfect. There's still moments where you're like, come on, watch, you can do better. But it's so much better than it used to be. It just took them, you know, three years to do that.
Yeah. Well, and I was, our friend Lex Friedman was complaining to me that when he switched phones recently, his biggest gripe is, even though you have an iCloud backup that stores all your passwords and stuff like that, you still probably end up with a lot of apps that you have to re-log into.
But that's the funny thing is it's totally the fault of the apps.
Yes.
Is my understanding.
Exactly.
Is that, although there is one case, I don't understand why my Google account, which is in settings, isn't backed up. And I don't know if that's a decision on Apple's part or on Google's part. But every time I restore, I have to re-enter my Google account in the accounts part of
the settings app. I haven't had to re-enter mine. I've had to re-enter my password, I feel like,
I mean. Yeah. I have to re-enter my password, and I don't want to do that. Now, most apps, if they're using the keychain, you know, you should be able, or 1Password, you can just now, you can do that in there. But they can also store them in the backup if they want to.
Yeah, the hilarious issue I used to have, which is no longer a thing apparently, is I sync my 1Password database via Dropbox, and invariably I would get a new phone, and I would go into 1Password, need to sync the vault, realize I need to log into Dropbox, go to the Dropbox app, realize where it's my password is super long and complicated in 1Password, and then I'd be like,
Yeah, now that I'm using 1Password's online syncing, it's not a problem, and I think the password database gets backed up now, so... I no longer experience that.
I haven't run into that. I didn't run into it this year, so I assume that they did it smarter.
Yeah, it's much better now. They figured that part of it out. So you still have to enter in your master password, but it's already backed up, so it restores your database as it was. And then when you log in, it unlocks the database and logs you into their sync service, and then you're up and running without having to do anything. And then like Dropbox, I think I didn't even need to re-enter my password in Dropbox.
Yeah, I did not need to this time,
because I think it's storing those credentials and it's fine.
I might have had to put in like a PIN code or something.
Maybe.
I don't really.
But it's
way smoother, and this is smart of Apple, of course, because they want to make it really easy for people to buy new phones.
Exactly. And it is supposed to be. This is what Mike and I did. I think the first episode of Upgrade that ever really kind of got widely pointed to by people was when we talked about the Upgrade experience, and we said at the time, it's like, this should be, as a tech nerd, this should be like the happiest day, one of the happiest days of your tech acquisition life for the year or two or three, is new iPhone day. And then it's a slog. It's like, no, it should be happy.
That said, there are these lingering things, and I've complained about this. I don't remember if I talked about this on this show the other week, but I think I've talked about it in some of my other shows. So the feature where your text messages, non-iMessages, get forwarded to your Mac from your iPhone is totally broken for me. I can't get it to work on my new... Ever since I switched phones, I've not been able to get messages, standard non-iMessage text messages on my Macs. And I find it very irritating. And I've tried, you know, turning it on and off again. It's supposed to, like, prompt you for, like, a PIN code when you activate it. And it just like, flips on and off and, like, nothing seems to happen.
And you've gone into the text message forwarding setting and settings?
Yep, that's what I've done that. I've checked where the messages come from, like, what's your originating address, for example, because sometimes that causes problems. And it's consistent, and I've logged out of iMessage on my Macs, and, like, I'm at the point where... Do I log out of iCloud on my Mac and log back in? Because that would probably fix it, but also, as I think John Gruber wrote recently in an article, it's so annoying now.
Yeah.
Like, logging out of iCloud is now kind of a nuclear option thing, because, yes, you'll get all your stuff back,
but it's
so time-consuming and annoying.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of like, I still haven't upgraded to Mojave on my iMac, and I'm like, well, maybe that'll, like,
shake it up.
Whatever bits need to be kicked and fix it. But, you know, at the moment, that's kind of the next thing I try.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's always some lingering weirdness, especially with, like, iCloud and sync stuff. Like, I had some problems earlier this week. I know Apple had some problems with iCloud this week, but, like, I've had some issues with emails sent from my iCloud account not correctly syncing across mailboxes. So, you know, it's just, sync is weird. It's a bizarre problem. And sometimes these things just get out of sync and there's no real good way to be like, kick everything, just like start again, get your house in order.
The laundry is, spinning now, so I hope everybody's enjoying that. I have an iPhone XR here.
Oh,
yeah,
the R is for really speed. Yeah,
remember when they did the S is for speed, and then they walked that back and like, no, we were just kidding. It doesn't mean anything.
Well, I saw the interview with Schiller this time where he said R and S are both sort of car things that denote like special cars.
They
and
are meaningless.
That was kind of what they're going for. Yes, they are totally meaningless, and they are so hard to say. I caught my co-host on the rebound, John Moltz, multiple times this week saying XR.
I know it's very hard to do it. I've done it too, where I try to say 10R. But I will admit that when I'm in my mind, when I'm sub-vocalizing while I'm writing or reading, it's XR every time.
Sure, yeah.
But because in my two podcast letters. Voice, it's 10R. I will call it that. It's so. I just wrote a piece for our friend Phil, Tom's Guide, about. I've written so many different pieces about the 10R, and I still have my review to write for Six Colors, which I was hoping to do yesterday, and that didn't happen. So maybe I'll do it today. It's because I only got the phone, unlike the people who got it a week in advance and got to write it. Like, I got it like 2 days ago, so I'm still working on it. But it's great. There's my review of it. It's great. I feel for people who like smaller phones, because it's by far the best deal. If you like a small phone and do not want to spend $1,000 and you need a new iPhone, I just buy the iPhone 8. Like, seriously, there's no new. If you don't want to spend $1,000 on a phone and you like small phones, I mean, again, the SE is gone. It's over. I feel bad for you. I get why people are angry about it. But just like, if you need a new phone and you want a small phone and you don't want to spend $1,000 on a phone, or, you know, $1,150 if you get it above 64 gigs of storage, like, you got to go to the 8 because there's nothing in that slot.
This is the dilemma I'm having trying to convince my fiance to upgrade her phone, because she's got an iPhone 6, and it is, every time I have to use it for something, I'm like, how do you live with this?
Yeah.
Let me tell you,
the iPhone 8 is great.
Right, and that's probably what she'll do, because it's almost indistinguishable from her iPhone 6.
And now it's cheaper. It's $100 cheaper than it was last year. So I think the 8
that's
is
probably what's gonna
the
happen
answer for her. And Jamie has Lauren's old 8 now. Lauren's got my old 10. And, you know, the 8's great. It's a great phone. I mean, it's weird to me. I pulled out my review units yesterday, and there's some pictures that I posted on Twitter of all of these phones together where you can see the size of them. And, like, I had to get some of them started up, and like the home button, I was like, I don't even remember. I tried to take a screenshot with the two side buttons, and I was like, oh, you got to use the home button, don't you? Like, I've completely left the world of the home button behind.
The one that always gets me is the fact that it doesn't have tap to wake, and I'll sit there and tap on the screen a bunch, and I'm like, why is this phone not turning on?
Yeah, it's so. Leaving that all aside, though, 10R, it is really good. It's in the price slot that used to be before last year, the Plus model. So it's $100 more, essentially, than what the base model new iPhone used to be, and $50 more than it was last year. But I will say, it is smaller than the Plus, a very little bit, but it is smaller than the Plus. It's got a nice screen. I think for a group of people who are not... who do not really, really, really want a small phone, are open to the possibility of a larger phone. It's worth going into an Apple store and holding it in your hands, because it is by far the best deal. I mean, like, Gruber did a little grid that I thought was really good on his review of this on Daring Fireball, because it's not just that it's $250 cheaper than the 10S, and $350 cheaper than the 10S Max. So that's a vast difference there, right? Yeah. But more than that, like, the next step up in storage, if you don't want the 64, on the 10S, you have to go to 256, and it's $150 upgrade. Whereas on the 10R, you can max out the 10R's storage to 256, and it's still cheaper than a 10S. Like, right. the bump up to get 128, a size that's not available on the 10S at all, is not unreasonable, and it's still a pretty good price. So if you're we talk a lot about the base prices, but it's sometimes interesting to look at what the mid-tier price is. And the mid-tier price, right, it's even cheaper than the 10S's at that price. So, like, there are... I feel like unless you really, really, really want a small phone, in which case the 10S is going to be a better choice for you if you've got the money to spend, or you've got some very particular... like, you're a super... nerdy display OLED person who's like gonna freak out at not having the blackest blacks on the screen like the 10, but you know, the 10R screen, like, it's better than essentially any other iPhone screen before the 10. It's that technology. It still looks really good. The blacks are still pretty black. They're just not OLED black. If you don't need the telephoto lens, if you don't take a lot of portrait mode, although it still does portrait mode for faces, it just doesn't have the parallax, so it has to kind of... it's all... I don't want to say fake it, because it's all fake, but it has to fake it more with machine learning and focus pixels instead of having the parallax. But it's all fake. So, like, there is no... I read an article somewhere where they said, unlike the 10S, the 10R has to do this kind of fakery to blur the background. And I'm like, no, the 10S is doing fakery too.
That background is not blurry.
The 10S is gathering more information from reality to build its depth map from which it does its fakery. But it's still fakery. It's like, you know, there's still software just blurring the background is what's happening in both cases, but there's more data applied to the 10S than to the 10R. And, like, it doesn't do 3D touch, but for, like, all the places where I use 3D touch, it does haptic touch, so it hasn't really mattered to
me. That's a really interesting decision to me still, the haptic touch thing, because as you pointed out in one of your articles, I think, and several other people have mentioned as well, obviously it doesn't work every place 3D touch works, because sometimes the long press already has a meaning in those places, like rearranging icons on the home screen. But 3D touch is one of those super weird technologies that I think it's a perfectly fine technology. I think it's always been kind of a nerdy technology because it's hard to... most people don't know it's there. And I think it's sometimes a little finicky in the way that it works. But it's also expensive, and they can't get it across all the entire iOS line. So it's always been this little weird, like... thing that's in some devices and not in other devices. And I always find it a bizarre technology, because it seemed like something they wanted to spread across all the devices and they just couldn't make it work. So I kind of feel like, is this purely a cost-saving measure, or are they backpedaling a little bit on the existence of this technology?
I don't know. I mean, it is a luxury feature. I think some of it is that literally to get the 10R to work, because they wanted it to be edge-to-edge. And yeah, the bezels are slightly larger, but I think that you wouldn't notice unless you were literally, like, had a 10S and a 10R next to each other and were looking, because they both have a slight frame, and the frame is just slightly larger on the 10R. But they had to do lots of crazy stuff in terms of cutting the edges and doing masking of pixels on the edges to make the curves and stuff that an LCD screen doesn't usually do. Mm-hmm. That's what OLEDs are good for, and yet they're like, we want that OLED design, but on an LCD screen because it's cheaper. And they did it, and they had to really change the backlight to do that. And I think that the backlight probably kicked out, more than anything else, probably kicked out 3D Touch. But I don't know. Like, the iPads, I feel like... Personally, I feel like haptic touch is where they're going to go with everything.
Consistency.
Well, let's see about the iPads next time. Like, I kind of feel like they should just put haptic touch in the iPads, the iPad Pro that we see next week. Why not? Because you can do haptics in the iPad. That's not a problem. You could totally do that. You're going to need more. Engines. If they don't do it, it's going to be because they, you have to have a bunch of different haptic motors in different places that go off in unison or something, because it's such a large space versus an iPhone. But like, haptic touch will get you most of the way there, and it's consistent, and it's available on, theoretically, on all devices, because it's just a touch and hold with a buzz. It's nothing special. And 3D touch will never, unless it goes to every device, it will never be widely adopted. It'll always be a bonus feature. Exactly. So I'm a believer in haptic touch. I think that's the way forward for Apple, because they can just throw out the engineering for 3D touch, or they will figure out some other way to do pressure sensitivity down the road. But it's easier just to use with what you've got, which is touch sensitivity. They've already got that, and time.
Yeah, and I think people get that more than they got 3D touch. The thing that always I struggled with a little bit on the iPhone X when I first got it is exactly what they're using the haptic touch for on the iPhone XR, which is like the flashlight and camera buttons. Like, it took me a while for my brain to process the idea, like, okay, this works like a physical button where you have to press it, like, hard. It's not a tap, it's a press. And, like, I like it. It's a perfectly fine feature. But it did take my brain a little time to wrap around, because of the fact that, like, it wants you to treat it like a physical button, even though it is not a physical button.
Yeah. The other mystery of the XR to me. So, the colors are great. The colors are great. Like, how many times have I said over the last few years, I really wish Apple would embrace color again. iPods used to have so many fun colors and all of that. There was that one red iPhone that they did like 6 months afterward for the 8. And yet on their laptops, you get light gray or dark gray or maybe gold. Or maybe gold with a slight rose tint in one case, right? Like, it's so limited to kind of these metallic shades. And they're kind of monochrome. And it's boring. And it's classy, but it's boring. And this thing has 6 different colors, 2 of which are white and black. So if you want boring, you can get boring. But they got a blue that is gorgeous. They've got yellow, which is super bright and nice. There's the product red, which is very pretty. And then they've got the one that I've got in my hand right now, which is this orangey thing that they're calling coral. And I love it. It's awesome. There are some issues. The shiny back and the anodized aluminum ring are not the same materials, and therefore they are not quite the same. They are trying to make them complementary, and I think it's going to be up to everybody's personal taste how they feel about that. The yellow doesn't work for me for some reason. It's okay, but like it's sort of like a gold ring with a bright yellow back, and I'm not sure those colors work for me, but in general they're really nice. I love them a lot. Apple is not selling Apple branded cases for the XR, and this is the mystery part, which is like, this is a beautiful phone, as is the 10 and the 10s. They're all beautiful phones with beautiful backs, and you really need to put them in a case. Right. And it's a shame, because they are so beautiful, and these even more than the others are so beautiful that they're really made to not have a case. The anodized aluminum ring makes it, I think, much more easy to hold the XR and grip it well. If I had a XR, if I ended up with a XR as my main phone, I don't think I would put it in a case, because it's so beautiful. At the same time, if I drop it, it's got a glass back, it's going to break, it's going to be super sad. But I'm fascinated by the fact that Apple, I was listening to, I want to say ATP, and they were speculating that something happened and Apple just couldn't get the XR cases out in time, the Apple branded ones. I'm like, really? I don't believe that. I believe that Apple wants this thing to come out And be like, you don't even need to put it in a case. I think it's really telling that the only cases that Apple is selling for the XR on its website and presumably in the stores are these clear cases, these OtterBox like clear cases.
Right.
Because I think that's basically what Apple's saying here is the XR, you got to see it. Like the whole point of it is that it needs to be seen and it is beautiful, but it's just going to be the saddest thing in the world if you have to put this thing in a case because you're going to lose that gorgeous color. I would not want to put this coral XR in a case because it's so pretty.
There was a rumor at one point that Apple was going to produce their own clear case, but it's never showed up. Like, and it was apparently in the press release in some countries like Canada, they mentioned that there was going to be a clear case. Or so I've seen reports of.
So it's possible. It's possible.
Maybe it'll happen.
It's possible. Maybe they had an issue with a clear case, but that's the way I would do it. If I were Apple, I'd be like, no. We need to show off how this looks. I don't know what that material that is and how they do
that. You want a silicone case that's got a bunch of holes in it? That's not what you're looking for?
Well, I mean, actually, though, that is a point, which is at the very least, you would have expected them to come up with a bunch of silicone cases in the XR color. Right. So you could just get a case that matches your XR, and they didn't do that either.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a little strange. I agree. I mean, Apple is a company which has not been shy about making a buck or two on cases and promoting the way it feels like. Yes, if you want the best experience, you'll get this Apple case. They certainly have not held back on that on any of their other models. So it is interesting because one would think they would want it here, but. Yeah, who knows? I get the temptation to take the phone out of the case. Sometimes I'm playing with my iPhone XS, and I'll take it out of the case. Like, oh man, this is a really nice phone. I had that when I was doing the transfer because I got the new phone. I was like, man, this is a really nice phone. And then I put it back in the case. I'm like, yeah, now it feels like my phone again, not like some weird piece of art that I've picked up because it is gorgeous. But like, I could not use it without a case.
Yeah, I don't know, like, maybe if you're, I don't know, you've got AppleCare and you're feeling lucky.
I got AppleCare, but I'm not willing to risk it. Sorry. I've been very lucky not destroying any phones of mine. But yeah, it seems like why risk it?
Yeah. What else going on? Anything else?
Well, we've just cleared the iPhone XR in time to have the other event next week. So.
Yeah, I'm flying. So I went to Chicago for Upgrade Live, and now it's time for Apple event in Brooklyn. So I'll be flying. The ATP did make reference to me complaining. I really didn't complain that much. I know that people travel for Apple events. I don't usually. I usually just drive to them, and now I have to fly. And it's like, no, it's fine. I'll do it. But... It is true that I have been incredibly spoiled by having basically every Apple event happen in my backyard.
Somebody, I think it was John Martorello, I can't pronounce his last name, from Mac Observer, John Martorello, who was mentioning on Twitter yesterday, like, oh man, like the event is 10 a.m. Eastern, so it's going to be hard for people on the West Coast to get up. And I was like, you know what? I order phones at 3 a.m. You guys can suck it.
Yep. That's how I was going to say.
Sorry, I feel no sympathy.
In the words of The Good Place, y'all can suck it. Like, it's just,
you like, deal. 10 a.m. That's beauty. Yeah. That's great.
But the key is, as we found out with the Chicago event, is everybody's got it wired for 10 a.m. Pacific in their local time. So I have made a point several times of pointing out it's a 10 a.m. Eastern, which means wherever you are in the world, it's 3 hours earlier than you're used to an Apple event happening. So be aware of that. But yeah, so I'll be there Tuesday morning in Brooklyn. It's not that I haven't been to Brooklyn. I've been to Brooklyn. My sister-in-law used to live in Brooklyn. But I've like never like stayed there in a hotel and gone to an event. So that's kind of fun. I will say to the Secret Podcast listeners, if you are in New York and you would like to come and say hi to me and have a drink, this is not an event. I'm not buying you a drink, but you could buy yourself a drink. You don't have to buy me a drink if you don't want to, but I'm not going to buy you a drink probably because it's not one of those kinds of events. It's just me showing up at a bar, but I will be at Hinterlands Bar in Brooklyn on Monday night. I'm depending on timing. I might bring Federico Vittici with me. We'll see. I don't know how he's feeling. I don't know when he's flying in, but he is staying at the same hotel that I am, in Brooklyn. So I don't know when I'm going to be there. I want to say like 7. But I'll keep watching the skies, keep watching Twitter and Six Colors, and I'll put it out there. But if you are in New York and you want to go to Brooklyn, Deepest Darkest Brooklyn, and say hi to fellow nerds and me, you can do that. I will be there. And Hinterlands Bar, for those who don't know, which is probably most people, is owned by Stuart Wellington, who is one of the three hosts of my favorite podcast, The Flophouse. And it's nerd-themed. It's got, like, fantasy maps on the walls and stuff like that, and they have games and all sorts of stuff, too. So I think it will be a welcoming space for our people. So people can check that out.
And I'll build right off of that and
yes,
say,
you
if
will
you
also
are in
be
New
in
York,
New York.
I will not be in New York at the same time as Jason, but I will be there in the same week. Ironically, it's very strange. I'm rarely in New York.
Yes, also, if you were in New York, you just missed, or maybe you went to, the Live Connected that they did last night with Mike and Steven and Marco Arment.
You got a busy couple weeks.
There's a lot going on in New York, so I realize that people may not come see me on Monday because they're like, oh, I already did that. Or I saw Dan live in Manhattan performing Radio Theater.
Yeah, apparently I'm doing a radio theater show on Friday, November 2nd, where I will be accompanied by our friend David Lohr.
And a bunch of, like,
and, like
professional actors
this
from
is
Broadway.
The more I think about this, the more I wonder, what did I get myself
Dan,
into?
Dan, at the end of this, they're going to tap you on the shoulder, and they're going to say, kid, you're going to make it in Broadway, and they're going to haul you off, and you're going to be cast in a Broadway musical. It's going to happen that. It's going to be A Star is Born, except without Lady Gaga.
And less hair.
And
Yeah, so if you're in New York and want to come see a radio theater show for The Incomparable, you can do that on Friday night. I think it's at 54 Below at 9:30, I want to say. That'll be interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. People should check that out. That's a radio theater live. 54 Below, which is literally the theater below Studio 54, former Studio 54. And real live radio theater with Dan. In fact, Dan, I have to say, one of the things, because I've been thinking, it's been a year since I visited you, and I've been thinking about how I want to do another kind of Northeast trip, because I know so many people in Boston and New York, and I like to see them, and I used to work for a company, as you did, that had its headquarters in Boston, and so I would get called back there every so often, and that hasn't happened lately, so I've made little visits. And when this thing came up in Brooklyn, I was like, oh, man, I wonder if I could do it. And I thought about that for a minute, but the problem is, one, with an Apple event, you get less than 2 weeks' notice, and I already have, like, I have family stuff, I have podcast stuff, I have so much stuff scheduled that I would have to tear up if I lingered or if I went in early. But I did have that moment where I thought, well, I could... maybe stay a few extra days and go up to Boston. I had that thought of like, oh, but Dan's going to be coming down to New York and it's going to be this whole, I'm like, nah, forget it. I'm just going in. So I'm actually going in on Monday night and leaving on Tuesday night. So my itinerary is hilarious. It's like fly in, check into the hotel, go to the bar, hang out, have the meetup, go back, go to sleep, wake up, Apple event, immediately take the subway to, assuming the subway is working, which I hear sometimes doesn't happen in New York these days, to Manhattan, to the studios of our friend Lex Friedman and his company, Stitcher, formerly Midroll. They have a studio space waiting for me. I'm going to do live upgrade with Mike in that studio space. He's going to be in Toronto. He had to change his plane to go back home a day later so that he and I could do that. It's a whole thing. And then I go from there to the airport and I fly home.
Yeah. Well, speaking as someone who used to do that dance to fly out to San Francisco and would often, I've definitely spent less than 24 hours in California as a result of Apple events.
It's wacky, but it'll all be good. So it's going to be a big week and I'm really excited about it. We haven't even talked about that part of it, but like, I'm really excited about it. I'm excited for two reasons. I feel like Marco, this so often happens that when Marco says things on ATP, I'm reminded why Marco and I aren't on a lot of podcasts together, because we say a lot of the same things. And we, you know, like I listen to ATP and I'm like, yep. Mm-hmm. And what he was saying this week was basically, I'm excited about the event because although we know some of the broad sketches of it, we don't know any of the details. Like the iPad Pro, we know some specifics, but yet there are whole things, as I said on Upgrade this week, like that connector on the back, nobody knows what it is. Like we've seen the shape, because of the like case leaks and stuff. But like, even if that's a real thing, nobody knows what it is. There's speculation, but nobody knows. Now, I'll grant you, Mark Gurman will probably post a story on Monday morning that ruins everything. But right now, it's sort of delightful that we don't really know. Also, I love the iPad Pro. I want a new iPad Pro. I love the idea that Apple might get their consumer laptop line in line. And I'm kind of in the market for a consumer laptop too.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of in the market for a Mac Mini, and that's out there. And now, although I don't think it's going to happen in this event, though it could, there's even a rumor that they're actually going to do a new iPad Mini, which is wacky.
Yeah.
So
what,
like,
what a weird world we're living in right now.
This could be, I mean, I want to say that it sets us up for disappointment when some of this stuff doesn't come, but I feel like I kind of feel like this event, you can't lose because whatever,
at least you get something.
That's right. There may be boxes they don't check, but every box they check, I think, is going to be delightful. So that's great. I'm really
yeah, like,
looking
forward.
Worst
case scenario is we come out of this with new iPad Pros that have no bezel and have Face ID. Like, that's the worst case scenario, is that's all you get.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty good scenario.
I mean, yeah, as an iPad Pro, I had this moment not too long ago. I'm not sure if I mentioned it here or not. I'm sitting in bed reading or whatever, and I need to authenticate, and or I'm typing on it in laptop mode somewhere, and I need to authenticate. And I had that moment of realization, which as I reach out to do the Touch ID, which is, oh, my face is already here. Like, it's already unlocked if it's got Face ID. And I was like, oh boy, that's going to be big. That's going to be great. Like, just to be, especially using a keyboard, right? Like, do, you know, need to switch. Oh, I need to authenticate, and not to have to reach out and touch the Face ID and all of that. Like, it'll just like, hey, it's you. And then we keep on going. Like, I'm looking forward to that. I use the iPad Pro all the time. So a nice, smaller bezel Face ID kind of model, I think it'll be awesome.
Yeah, I'm very happy with my current iPad Pro right now, so that I'm not in the market to upgrade quite yet. But as I've talked about in previously, my MacBook Air has been having some issues. Did this again today, where it just suddenly decides it's going to crash and lock up, and then when I try to start it up again, it's like, oh, you need to plug me in. I'm like, your battery is fully charged. I don't know what your problem is. And so I know I can replace the battery. I've had many discussions about this on Twitter. I'm kind of reluctant. The main reason I'm reluctant to just swap the battery out is I'm not 100% sure whether this is a battery problem or perhaps some other connector with the battery, because there's other parts involved there. And somebody, a friend, suggested it could be like a, you know, a micro soldering break or something like that. And it's like, all right, there's no guarantee that replacing the battery will fix this problem. And I don't necessarily want to go out and spend, you know, $70 or $80 and then be like, oh, well, that didn't really do it. But I'm curious because of the fact that I do love my 11-inch MacBook Air. And I'm guessing that whatever Apple releases won't be, you know, exactly what I want, which is a MacBook 11-inch MacBook Air with a Retina display. That's not going to happen. But I'm curious to see what that looks like, because it's not going to be the MacBook, right? Presumably, they're going to have to cut some corners, because the whole problem with the MacBook was that it couldn't get it cheap enough. And it's going to have to be, I feel like, at least something of a substantive upgrade over an old MacBook Air. And I don't know what's in that space. Like, there's a lot of range in there for what that might be. Could be as simple as, like, a new MacBook Air that has some USB-C ports on it, or it could be something that's much closer to a MacBook. I don't know. But I'm intrigued. I'm not sure that I would run out and buy one right away, but I want to see what that spot is, because this is a hole. This has been a big hole in their lineup for a while now.
It really has.
And because everybody is ending up, I feel like most people in the market for a MacBook have ended up on like that 13-inch MacBook Escape, because it kind of is the closest to, it's pretty light and pretty small, but it's also pretty powerful.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have the touch bar.
Yep.
And that's kind of a sweet spot. And so I'm kind of curious to see. I wrote my column this week on the collision of the iPad Pro and the consumer level MacBook, where I feel like these are two devices that fundamentally play in very similar spaces. And what Apple does with its iPad and its MacBook next week, if it does indeed release updates to both of those product lines, is going to tell us a lot, I think, about where they see that mobile computing device market going. Is this just like, you can have whatever platform you want, but we have two devices that kind of are in similar price ranges and do a lot of the same things. But if you want like a convertible tablet or a touchscreen, you go here. And if you want like multitasking and windowing and the laptop form factor, you go here. Do we end up with a thing that's more like a laptop for the iPad, right? Like these are interesting questions, because this is one place where those two product lines really do intersect. You know, most people aren't going to make a decision between, do I want an iPad Pro or do I want an iMac or a Mac Mini, right? Like, that is not a comparable machine, because if you need an iMac, you're getting an iMac, not an iPad Pro.
Right.
But for a lot of people, if you need a portable computing device that does a lot of, like, your email and your web browsing, like, that's an open question for you. That's mostly a matter of preference. So I'm very curious to see where they go there, because I think it'll tell us a lot.
Yeah, if I had to make a guess,
and you do,
I don't. I want to think is that there will be a brand new sub-thousand thing that is the MacBook Air replacement, and that it will be more like the MacBook or the MacBook Escape, or like the 10R, right? Where it's like kind of scaled down to where they can hit a lower price point. And it's entirely possible that it will be really underpowered at $999, and that you will need to do upgrades to it that will immediately kick it way up in price. Like that, I feel like that may be where they're headed. But still, we'll get them that, you know, that sub-thousand system. I you know, whether it's an entirely new thing or whether it's the MacBook Escape kind of designed to get it down there, I think is an open question. I wonder of the fate of the MacBook Escape in general. Like, is it dead, or is it getting repurposed as a different product? Because it is really the Air of the MacBook Air. It is Air, H-E-I-R.
I made that joke in my column,
which
I stole from Lex Friedman. So yeah. It's been all the way around.
Lex, you can take it next. It is that, like, in terms of the tech that's inside it, it's just that they priced it way too high for the MacBook Air, and then they've cut it in price, and it's still way too high for the MacBook Air. So
right.
Part of me wants to say this new sub-$1,000 laptop is just going to be the MacBook Escape pushed down further with a Pro name taken off of it. Like, that, I think that's a real scenario. I would love it if it's a, what many of the rumors are, which is a new design that Apple, like, has had a back to the drawing board, lower cost sub-$1,000 laptop that they're pushing. But it wouldn't shock me. I mean, that would be big, because they would have had to just decide several years ago that they were going in that direction. And I thought that was what the MacBook was supposed to be, right? So I don't know. I'm looking forward to that too. Yeah, all of it is great. Like, I again, it's all like, what candy you get from the candy store is essentially what we're talking about here.
Right.
Like, there's all this different great stuff that we've been talking about, and we're probably not getting all of it, right? But I think what we get will be fascinating.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm looking forward to it a lot. I think there's a lot less known in some ways about these announcements than about the announcements we got in September. Like, in some ways, despite the things like the 10R, we kind of knew that was coming. The 10S, I think most people would agree, just like, from a perspective of perception, felt underwhelming. It's a perfectly fine phone, but like, it was never going to be the blockbuster that the 10 was, right? Like, you know, that doesn't come along every year. And so I feel like there was muted approval of those announcements, and like, those of us who are in the community were like, these are really good, they're really solid, they're just not flashy necessarily, because they're not brand new, or they're not like really big shifts in the product line. But I think that this has the potential to really do that. There's at least 2 to 3 products in here that, you know, have been lying fallow for well over a year, or in the Mac Mini's case, 4 years. So there's a lot of questions about what those changes are going to look like.
Well, and keeping in mind something like the Mac Mini, like, when they release that is, I think we need to assume at this point that, like, that's going to be the Mac Mini for the next 3 years, 4 years, right?
at least.
Right? So that's important. I like, there hasn't been a lot of rumor about this. I like the conversation about the iMac and where it's going. And I think I've seen 2 fascinatingly different perspectives on it, which is one person saying, and other people agreeing with them, that the iMac really doesn't need much, just, you know, speed bumps and all that, and keep it moving along, and maybe get rid of, you know, there shouldn't be a publicly available non-Retina iMac and all that. It's like, that's fine. And then other people saying the iMac needs a total redesign. It's old, and those bezels are huge, and you know, you need to take out the, basically design it without a spinning hard drive space in it, and give it a complete redesign. And I think both of those, are true, which is, I do think the iMac needs a redesign. I'm not sure it needs it right now, but it does need it eventually, and they could do it this year, except I don't think there's been any rumor of that, which leads me to believe that it won't be this year, maybe next year. But as I sit here in front of my iMac Pro, also there's the argument that you put out the iMac Pro and then you immediately redesign the iMac. Maybe you do. I don't know. Maybe they're on parallel tracks where the iMac Pro is designed to use all the space in the old iMac design for ventilation, and then a new iMac won't need that, and so they'll make different trade-offs. I don't know. But it is true that the iMac does have enormous bezels and an enormous chin, and mm-hmm. I wonder if they are working on something for a next-gen iMac, but it seems unlikely that will happen this year, and that it's more likely that they will just refresh, you know, put new processors in. They have the ability to put a 6-core as a build-to-order in the iMac if they want to do that, which I think would be fine. Some people said they probably won't do that because they want to protect the iMac Pro. I don't, Stephen Hackett brought this up at Upgrade, and I think it's right. Like, I don't think that's an issue. That'll be a build-to-order model. You'll still pay $3,000 for it. It'll be fine. So we'll see. But I feel like discussing where the iMac goes next is worth a conversation, assuming that it doesn't happen this time, which I think it won't. And then I think it'll be worth having that conversation. You and I will have to rush to see which one of us will write that column for Macworld first.
True. It's a week away.
Ready, set, go. Okay, we should wrap it up. I'm going to New York, but I'll be back in a week, so we'll talk about this then, and I'll be on a bunch of podcasts, and you'll be on a bunch of podcasts to talk about it in the interim. And my laundry is almost done, so it's very exciting.
Excellent.
Thanks to everybody out there for reading Six Colors and supporting the site and the podcast and all that. We appreciate it. And hi to everybody who's in the Slack. If you're not in the Slack, you should go in there. There's nice people in there and lots of fun conversation in the Six Colors member Slack. All right. I've got to start packing my bags. Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.
Oh, it's spinning down. There it goes.